The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
We've had a lot of contact from listeners as to why we here on The Last Word and the media in general has reported so extensively on the rape trial in Belfast and broadcast what was often very graphic and upsetting detail. I'm not going to offer any comment on what other media did, but I can try to explain our position here on The Last Word, what we're responsible for. And we fully appreciate that much of what we heard over the last 9 weeks or so was awful and often very distressing. And that's why I issued a warning most nights that you might like to go elsewhere for a little while or turn down the volume, particularly if you had children who were listening. In the first place, we began coverage of the trial because high-profile individuals were involved. Now, you can ask if that was a good enough reason, and maybe it wasn't. But if we had decided not to report what was happening publicly in a courtroom in this island because those individuals had a high profile, then we could have been accused of a form of censorship because of who they were, of protecting them. So it was something of a catch-22 situation for us. Now, at this point, I should mention that there's a difference in the way that justice is administered north and south of the border in this island. If these men had engaged in their behaviour south of the border and had a prosecution been started, then their identities would have been protected until the conclusion of the trial. And in the case of a not guilty verdict, they would never have been disclosed publicly, although I suspect word might have leaked out in social media, given the way things have happened in recent years. We started our coverage by reporting the outline of the prosecution case, and we did so without comment, even though many people on social media publicly arrived at their conclusions in advance of hearing the defence evidence or the cross-examination of the complainant. On a number of occasions during the setting out of the prosecution case, we discussed at our daily editorial conferences whether our coverage was excessive or appropriate. We decided after consideration that the public was interested, but that more importantly, there was a public interest involved in presenting to the public details of how a rape case was prosecuted and defended. We were somewhat stunned, however, by just how long the complainant was forced to remain in the witness box and by the type of cross-examination entered into by the defence barristers. Again, without expressing an opinion as to its validity, it certainly opened the eyes of many of us as to what actually happens in a rape case to the woman who says she's a victim and for how long it might go on. Now, having heard the details of the prosecution case on a daily basis, we felt we had a duty to do exactly the same for the cases of the four defendants. Not to have done so might have implied that we were only willing to hear the prosecution side because we believed it and that we didn't want to hear the defence. So we continued with our daily coverage, much as I didn't like much of what I heard, but because it was fair to do so. So do I have personal opinions as to what happened? Of course I do, but I didn't air any during the course of the trial, not just for fear of saying something that could be deemed prejudicial, even if that was unlikely, but because I was aware that I was only hearing a portion of what the jury was hearing, albeit what our professional court reporter Frank Graney deemed to be the most important bits for broadcast. I'm also well aware there are now genuine concerns as to whether or not all of the publicity, as well as the verdicts themselves, will dissuade other women from coming forward when they believe they have been the victim of rape and assault. That is understood, but it needs to be emphasised again that this may be even more unlikely because any case in the Republic would not get a level of publicity like this because the identity of the defendants would not be known. The ordeal of questioning and proof would not change, however, and that may be a deterrent to many women. I'd love to know if there is a better way, and maybe we'll hear one over the next hour as we have our discussion, a process that is fairer on the complainant, but also respects the fact that a man or men have the right to plead their innocence of the charges brought against them and not to be found guilty incorrectly. Does what we've seen over the last couple of months make that close to impossible, however? Cliona Sadlier, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network Ireland, what are you taking from what has happened over the last couple of months and the difficulty involved in having fair trials?
Indeed. I mean, I think what we've always held is that the justice process that we have, the adversarial common law system, was never built to, it's never designed for this type of crime. It was designed primarily around things like property. And so we end up, we've been tweaking and we've been working on, and the rape crisis movement for 40 years has been working on improving the law to make it fit better, to make it suit better. So without sacrificing the right to a fair trial and the right to a good name, and indeed preserving best evidence, that you somehow find a way to give a position to the witness, because the complainant is just a witness in that case, and to give them protection and to treat them with dignity and respect, and make sure that what you end up with is what is in everybody's interest, that you have the best possible evidence and everyone is clear. It's done openly and in public, and everybody's clear at the end of it that justice has been done. That's the objective that we all share here.
The difficulty would appear, though, is that I suppose the men feel they have a right to defend themselves. They were pleading not guilty, so they got their barristers to do whatever was required to make sure that they were not convicted. The woman on the other side is telling what she believes to be the truth, and there is relatively little protection from the adversarial nature of the questioning.
What I would say, and there we need to put more protections in place. What we have is a victims directive that came in just last year, and we're not fully compliant with that. And what that does is that it has a series of measures that protect, special measures for the witness in particular in a court case, that protects them and gives them shields them against re-traumatisation that is not necessary for the purposes of best evidence and justice. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there, a lot of quite detailed work that needs to be done there. We have a report coming out of that very, very shortly, that we've been collaborating with some very senior people in the justice family around, and we're very clear there's a few things we can do there, but that will only get us so far. What we can see from the Belfast trial, and what we see over and over and over again, is at the end of the day you have the rules and the justice system as it is constructed, imperfect as it is and unfixable in many ways as it is, it's doing the best job it possibly can given where we started. The other big thing that we have in there is people's attitudes. So we have prejudice, we have culture, we have norms, we have sexism, we have misogyny, we have the whole of our society sitting in there in that courtroom. And so, as you say, the defence lawyer's job is to bring out, if you like, the worst in us, and is to tap into our bias, our prejudice, is to ask questions about the length of a skirt, is to ask questions about behaviour, is to ask questions about whether someone let themselves down, and all of those things. And they will only, these are professionals, highly skilled professionals, they are only going to ask that question in a courtroom to appeal to a jury if they think the jury will respond to that. So there's a question here for all of us, and what has arisen out in the trial is a conversation about consent and how we judge people, and in particular young women and sometimes young men in these circumstances. There's a question for us of what sort of bias and baggage we want to bring into a courtroom if we are a jury member. What will be tapped into by a defence lawyer when they are trying to discredit a complainant? And that's work we need to do.
Okay, I have other guests I want to bring in. Ro McDermott, of course, is with us on a weekly basis for our movies coverage, but she also is a Fulbright scholar with an MA in Sexuality Studies from San Francisco State University. Ro, I know you've been following this case closely. What's your observations as to what we've seen over the last 9 weeks and the verdict today?
Yeah, I think that point about these cases tapping into our biases is so important, because I think it's this case in particular and the way the defence was laid out tapped into so many cultural assumptions and misunderstandings that we have about the nature of sexual violence. So I think one that struck me is these myths that we have about the type of people who commit sexual violence. You know, the defence prosecutor said, you know, seriously, you believe a man would do this, a man who has no history of violence on or off the field? And that's referring to this cultural assumption we have that rapists and people who commit sexual violence are all incredibly violent people who can instantly recognise. It's the stereotype of a person down a dark alleyway with a knife, when over 90% of rapes and sexual violence are committed by someone the victim knows. So these are people's brothers, these are people's neighbours, these are people's boyfriends and ex-boyfriends. So the assumption that rape is always masked in this layer of violence by incredibly violent people who can instantly recognise, that's just not the case, and something we really need to get over. I think another thing that this case emphasised and the defence emphasised was that we still believe that consent is something that is that exists and has to be revoked, usually by women. The vast majority of sexual violence is committed against women. We believe that consent has to be revoked instead of established. And this idea, you know, that they set up that this woman was attracted to celebrities and she was attracted to Paddy Jackson, and therefore she consented to sex with him and multiple other men. That's establishing this idea that if you're attracted to someone, the answer is yes until you get a firm no. And then even then, we don't really believe people when they say they gave a firm no. But there was no, you know, the nature of this case demonstrated that there's no onus on usually men to prove that consent was established. The onus is on the victim to prove that it was revoked. And that's, of course, incredibly difficult to do.
Well, actually, Elaine Burns is with us as well, doctoral researcher in psychology at NUI Galway. And as it happens, you've been on this programme with us before talking about consent, because that is your specialist subject. This whole trial seemed to hinge on the aspect of consent. What did you make of it?
Mr. O'Donoghue said that central to this case is the issue of consent. Now, the difference between Northern Ireland and the Republic in defining consent is that we include intoxication as something that would not allow somebody to give their consent, and that isn't something that's considered. It's merely capacity in Northern Irish law. Now, when I like all of us, I've been following this case very closely as well. And when I heard the complainant give her evidence initially, I thought, and I applied my definition of consent to it, I thought her case was very, very strong. When she said that, how many times does a girl have to say no? And it was almost like apologising for being drunk when she was shown on CCTV stumbling in Ollie's. And I thought, well, When I define consent, one of the constructs within it is that consent is freely given. It's not something you can be pressured into giving. It can be revoked at any time and is never implied. And somebody cannot give consent if they are incapacitated by drugs or alcohol. So I thought immediately, well, that would indicate a certain level of incapacitation. In my own definition of consent, it's affirmative. The presence of a yes, not just the absence of a no, and no does not mean convince me. It's active. Silence is not consent, participation is not consent. And crucially, it is ongoing. Just because somebody agrees to one behaviour doesn't mean they agree to another.
But I think we have to emphasise that the jury has decided mm-hmm. that these four men were not guilty. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there about how we heard at the outset the prosecution case. Now, is there a case that many people came to conclusions based on the prosecution case without hearing all of the evidence?
Renroe touched on this. One of the things, and the defence actually in their summing up invoked this and used it very quite well, is the real rape stereotype. And when asked to describe a typical rape situation, most people will describe it as being a stranger. The victim was subjected to some amount of force and that they resisted. Now, that's both descriptive and prescriptive. It's descriptive in that it's what people use to typically describe a rape scenario, but it's also prescriptive in that all of those elements or some of those elements have to be present for somebody to have acknowledged that what happened was rape.
I think this is one of the reasons why the public have followed this case, and their reaction to it hasn't really dipped over the 9 weeks. The public have been reading and listening about this case, and I think it's not just because of the salacious details or the text messages or that we know them. I think it's because there's so much human behaviour that people recognise has happened to them or that they have done.
This could have happened with anybody. Yeah. This could happen with you, it could happen with your family members, anyway. I think it could have been anywhere.
Yeah. And I think that the four men who have all been found not guilty and all believed what they were doing was consensual, the woman believed it was not consensual. So I don't think anyone went up onto the stand over the 9 weeks and thought that they were lying. I think everybody thought the four men thought it was consensual and she didn't. I think that's why people are so interested, because we have never had a proper conversation about what consent is, because a lot of people don't want to have those conversations. They don't want to talk about sex in that way. They want to believe that everything that we do is done quietly and with permission, quiet permission, because we're still a little bit shamed about it.
And also when it comes to consent, it's regarded on a binary. Like, yes means yes and no means no. There's no consideration given to the grey area of consent. You know, when we introduce alcohol, when we introduce social norms, when we introduce gendered norms and gendered expectations, and the traditional sexual script where males are always initiated and males are always moving forward in sexual encounters, and females are the gatekeepers then deciding whether they get it or not.
Yeah. Roe, I want to put something to you that I put to Sinead O'Carroll earlier, that, you know, it is possible to believe the complainant and yet fully understand why the legal process led the jurors to decide that the four men were not guilty.
Yeah, because the legal process demands that there's enough irrefutable evidence and that there isn't any doubt. And even, I mean, the instructions to the jurors also did mention, which I think is important, that it wasn't important that they if they believed she could withhold consent, but the men had to believe that she was giving consent. So even that is acknowledging like the difference in perception rather than making it a black and white issue, which is, I think is such an important point that we've just raised. But I think that means that the legal process simply has to change. And we treat victims of sexual assault and rape like no other victims of no other crime. And if we acknowledge that, which I think most people do, looking at this trial, no other victim is subjected to this amount of shaming, this amount of blame, this amount of cross-examination. But then why are we so invested in maintaining how sexual assault cases are currently tried?
Okay, why, but what about the argument that has been put forward by many people that the shaming has been of the men who have now been found not guilty of a crime?
I would say, to be slightly flippant, look at my Twitter mentions today. The amount of people who've been on Twitter saying she is a slut and she needs to be named and shamed. I mean, I also feel this idea of people have made up their minds about this case. People only complain about that when people make up their mind that the men are guilty. People never complain about that if they make up their mind that the men are innocent. So even our reactions to it are just still displaying this idea that women are making false accusations all the time, which I think we've seen in the Me Too movement as well. We still have this cultural assumption that women do this. If anyone has been paying attention to the ordeal this woman has been subjected to, women do not do this. This is not fun for them. We do not get any cultural benefit from making false accusations. This is that's a phenomenon that should not be treated as a norm, and it really is being treated as a norm.
Listener says, interesting, you have three women on the panel. Well, it was four. We had Clina Sadlier as well. Male perspective. You wouldn't believe the amount of men who declined the opportunity to join us on the programme today. We made many requests and all of them were declined. So just to let you know. Of course, we did have Conor Hanley on earlier, Frank Rainey reporting on the trial. Conor Hanley, who is a sentencing expert, and he'll be back with us in a little while again here on the programme. Okay, but we're going to continue with our discussion
again,
of...
Isn't that interesting that some people don't want to hear from women?
Yeah, how often does that listener complain when it's an all-male panel? I wonder.
Let's continue the conversation, though. Because I am interested in this. Is there a different way to actually prosecute cases where there is rape? Elaine Burns, can you see a different way of doing it?
I went back to the work of Jennifer Temkin and Barbara Crahe. And Jennifer is a professor of law and Barbara Crahe is a professor of psychology, and they've collaborated on a number of research projects. But one was where they looked at the justice gap in sexual assaults and the role of attitudes in this. And when it came to juries, judges and barristers that they interviewed regarded juries as a barrier to conviction in rape cases. One judge said that juries are simply a microcosm of society itself. And even in my own research regarding rape myths, And these would be beliefs and perceptions that people would bring. These are ordinary, 11 ordinary men and women that make up a jury. So quite rightly, that justice said, a microcosm of society. But if we look at myths pertaining to rape, for example, if a girl doesn't say no, she can't claim rape. Of people that were surveyed as part of the SHAG report, 24% of females and 35% of males either agreed or weren't sure that if a female doesn't say no, she can't claim it was rape. 33% of females and 56% of males agreed or were not sure that a lot of times girls who said they were raped often led the guy on and then had regrets. And that, when we look at, again, the real rape stereotype, that if a victim or if a complainant isn't seen to be adhering to that construct, that they're regarded as being less likely to be believed.
Okay, there's something else I want to move to, and that's the text messages, which were not in themselves proof of rape or sexual assault, but did, I think, shock an awful lot of people the way that these young men, or men in their 20s, were describing the woman involved, the complainant, who was 19 years of age. I mean, in the first text, Stuart Olding described the night of sexual activity like a merry-go-round at a carnival. And again, I want to warn people that they may find this very distressing to listen to, particularly if you don't have children in the car. He said, "We are all top shaggers," he said in one text. "There was a bit of spit roasting going on last night, fellas," to which Paddy Jackson replied, "There was a lot of spit." And there were other such comments along the lines of that. Roe McDermott, the vast majority of men do not converse with each other like that.
I don't know if that's true,
I don't
to
know
be
men
quite
who
honest.
Do.
And that's fair enough, you don't. But we've seen, like, even if we look at Donald Trump and the defence of Donald Trump, like, oh, it's locker room talk, it's boys will be boys.
And many as men as women are very offended by that type of conversation. That's why we think Trump is reprehensible.
But I think, again, this feeds into the danger that we're not acknowledging the type of people who can engage in these kind of conversations. We're assuming it's really bad people who we would instantly recognise. But I think what these texts indicated to me is the idea of toxic masculinity. And to me, the idea of toxic masculinity is generally defined as the idea that men can only achieve power, whether that's economic or cultural or social, through dominance. And what these texts demonstrate is that these young men, and I mean, I even hesitate to say young, they're not young, they're old
20s.
Enough to know better. But I mean, you know, they weren't just referring to the defendant in these derogatory terms. There was a picture posted and with a caption saying, "I love Belfast sluts." Mm. So they're referring to all women like this. And they're referring to this idea that because they've had sex, in their minds, if, you know, they believe it's consensual, but this makes them more powerful. This makes them, in their word, legends. Because to have sex, to have dominance over someone, to have power, to have this kind of social power that comes from men having sex, a power that is not afforded to women having sex. Women who are viewed to have and enjoy sex are often, their social power is taken away from them. But it feeds into this idea that men can only achieve power through this form of dominance and through this form of rhetoric. And that's what we need to start combating. And I think it does mean we have to get uncomfortable. It does mean we have to start recognising that people who we would think of as nice boys, as good boys, talk about women like this because it's popular.
Because I think even themselves, they said afterwards, oh, you know, we were bragging, and they seemed quite embarrassed on the stand when you heard the reports. You know, I'm embarrassed by that now, hearing it back. But they weren't embarrassed at the time because they were talking in this safe space where all the other men in that group felt the same way about sex. And it goes back to how we don't talk properly about what sex is or what sex should be. Now, sex to them was roasting a girl. Like, is that the sex education we want our 20-year-old, 25-year-old men to think that I had a great night last night, we had such a laugh, it was great crack because I spit roasted a girl and then decided to call her loose and every such words for the next 24 hours over WhatsApp?
Elaine, is this probably part of what many people now think is a pornography culture, which has become much more prevalent in Irish society?
Well, actually, the WhatsApp messages between the chaps reflect what we call in psychology a callous sexual attitudes. And callous sexual attitudes are a construct then in hypermasculinity that would also include prowess, competitiveness, high achieving. Regarding pornography, actually, I work in a boys' school in South County Dublin. I'm piloting with Richie Sadlier a sexual health module with the boys. And it's a 6-week module, and on one of the weeks we focus on porn. And all of the boys, bar none, have been exposed to and have experienced and have watched porn. But one of the things...
So at what age?
They'd be 15, transition year students, but most of them would have started at about 11 or would have been exposed from about 11 or 12 years of age. And one of the things that's really important for us is that we're not judging them, we're not telling them not to watch porn, but to when they are, to watch it with a critical lens. And in fairness to them, they do have, and this is credit that we do not give to adolescent males in particular, is this capacity for critical evaluation when they're supported in the kind of an environment that we have provided for them. And that's something that is really, really lacking in how relationship and sexuality education is delivered in this country. I've just come from Leinster House from a briefing to which I contributed and spoke about my experience. Sex education in this country is wholly inadequate. it doesn't meet the needs of young people and it is obsolete at this stage. They need to be, when we do a pre-module questionnaire with the boys and we ask them, what are the three things that you want from this module? And there is remarkable consistency in what they say they want. They want healthy relationships, consent and contraception. Mm-hmm. And they are acutely aware of consent from the perspective of rape and a legal perspective. They're very aware of that. But I speak about consent because I, simple and all as I am, I distill it down to something that, that consent is has at its core respect. Respect for ourselves and respect for others, respect for our boundaries and others' boundaries.
Yeah, Sinead, this is what worries me and sort of astounds me to a certain extent because I thought modern generations, younger generations, where there's more co-ed schools, where there's more integrated, and there seems to be greater respect than there perhaps had been in previous generations, except this particular example, even if it's a not guilty for sexual assault and rape, does still suggest a sort of a cultural thing, which suggests this, we haven't improved.
Well, no, but there has been nothing put in place to allow us to improve. So we, when you're thinking about it, like in the early 90s, when I was 10, going on 10, contraception was allowed. And then we kind of became hypersexualized in a weird way while not talking about sex. So you get to an age of 15, 16 where there's a huge amount of, I guess there's an aura of sex around. Like there's, it's on television, it's on billboards, it's pervading you. Whereas you've never been taught like, well, how do I say no? How do I say yes?
Okay, there's a listener here totally disagrees with what you're saying about the text messages. When men talk like this, it shouldn't be taken seriously. These messages were never intended to go outside their group.
Okay, can I ask immediately, if these messages were coming from the defendant, they would absolutely be used to slam her character and to be used to say she absolutely wanted sex, she absolutely could, like, was consenting to everything. The way that she already has been shamed, the way she was, like, her apparent attraction or alleged attraction to celebrities was used as an excuse or as a reasoning of course you wanted to have sex with all of them. So of course these text messages, if they were sent by women, they would be taken seriously and used to judge the women. Why aren't we doing it to men?
To be fair to the millions and millions of men out there who would not send those text messages, they would not absolutely not see those as just crack and banter and something for a private space. They are sexist at best and misogynistic at worst and hateful at worst. And there is millions of men out there who would read them and think, if I was in that WhatsApp group, I would leave it. I know men who would have left that WhatsApp group if those messages had been sent. So I think it's really doing a disservice to men out there to say that is completely normal or acceptable behaviour, because it's not.
And I think that idea of let's not take it too seriously, it speaks to us again not wanting to be uncomfortable, not wanting to really analyse what's happening. And even when you were speaking there about educating young men, I've also written about, you know, the effects of pornography on young people and young people wanting to be educated, but parents and educators being so uncomfortable with recognising that teenagers have sexuality, recognising that teenagers, you know, watch pornography and not wanting to address it, though we're actually putting adults' comfort around uncomfortable conversations before the safety of young people.
Okay, Ro McDermott and Elaine Burns, thank you both for your contribution.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.